Maine's shoemaking industry, past, present, and future. At their height, Maine's shoe factories employed 50,000 people. Maine was at the center of the nation's shoe industry. Iconic brands with roots in the state include Bass, Dexter, L.L. Bean, New Balance, and Sebago. In the 1980s, Maine lost many of its shoe factories to other countries and Puerto Rico, but not all. New Balance employs about 900 people in central Maine today. L.L. Bean makes bean boots in Brunswick and Lewiston and is expanding its workforce due to demand. And other shoe companies, such as Rancourt & Company, are handcrafting loafers, dress shoes, and boots for niche markets. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss Maine's important connections to shoemaking and the potential for the future. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Shoemaking is a major part of Maine's history, and it continues to be one of the state's signature industries. Many of the huge mills around Lewiston and Auburn once produced all kinds of shoes that were then sold across the nation. That legacy continues. The bean boot is one of the world's most recognizable shoes, and beloved brands such as New Balance and Rancourt still make their shoes right here in Maine. Today we're going to talk about the role of shoemaking in Maine and the outlook for its future. In the studio with me, Rachel DeGrosier. Did I do a good job?
Very well.
Her family has been involved in shoemaking for years, and she is the executive director of the Museum LA in Lewiston. Mike Rancourt is co-founder of Rancourt & Company in Lewiston. Jack Sampson is L.L. Bean's vice president of fulfillment, manufacturing, and logistics. As always, we want to hear from you. Were you or someone you know involved in the shoemaking industry? Do you seek out shoes that were made in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I understand that all three of you have stories of how you and your family are involved in shoemaking. Rachel, I'm going to start with you. What is your family connection? What's your personal connection to shoemaking in Maine?
Well, my personal connection is when I was growing up as a young teenager, my relatives would all be involved, either working in the shoe shops. My mom worked in several shoe shops. But the thing that fascinated me was the fact that every morning we would have, at some of my aunts and uncles, they'd bring in these big basketfuls of leather things that they had to work on and so forth, and they had their own sewing machine at the house that the company brought in.
And so they didn't work in the plants. It was piecemeal.
Both. We had people, some of my relatives worked in the plants themselves, but a lot of people did kind of like in those days was the cottage industry of shoemaking, because the ladies stayed home, took care of the kids. At the same time, they would do their quotas, and in the evening, they'd come pick up, and the next morning, they'd get another. So we, at times, we tried to see if we could do it because it looked so easy, but it wasn't as easy as it looked, so we kind of gave it up.
And was it social? Would they get together when the kids went off to school? Would they, your aunts, for example, get together, or would they do each doing their own work at home by themselves?
Own work at home by themselves, and it was like they had to meet their quotas, and they wanted to meet their quotas because that's how they were getting paid and so forth.
And did you grow up in Lewiston?
I grew up in Lewiston.
Okay. Your turn, Jack. Tell me about your connection with shoemaking in Maine.
I've been in the manufacturing industry for 37 years, but my family, my mother used to sew shoes at home, and, you know, I remember as a kid taking the thread and running it through the wax, and I thought that was a big treat, so I was contributing to helping her go a little faster. But for the most part, my family, uncles and relatives have all worked in the footwear industry in the Lewis and Auburn area for over the years. I've been fortunate enough to work for many different companies in the footwear industry, but then I moved to L.L. Bean, and I've been with L.L. Bean for 29 years. So
29 years is a long time. Yeah. Who did you work with before that?
I worked for Etonic Treetorn and Charles Eaton and Bon-On.
Oh, a lot of different companies in Maine. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Lisbon.
Okay. So not just down the road?
Just down the road.
Okay, your turn. Mike, since your last name is Rancourt, the shoe company's Rancourt & Company, I'm going to take a wild guess that you were born into this.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting because when you ask that question, you know, I'm at this age now where I don't ever not remember being associated with the shoe business. You know, my dad bought his factory in 1967, but prior to that, you know, he would bring home, as Rachel just described, he'd bring home work for my mother. And so my mother would do this piecework at home. So I can still remember seeing the uppers, you know, sitting in the room, and it was called hand lacing, and they would insert them in one another like nesting. And then they'd wrap a rope. They'd take a rope and string it all together. And it was just a fascinating sight to see. And then, you know, my dad, when he bought the factory and we were old enough, he would bring us in when we were, you know, 8, 9 years old. I can remember the first time when the entire factory was there, and he was a moccasin maker, and he had 50 hand sewers, and it was so quiet because the hand sewers, hand sewing, there's no machinery required, and they would just stand there all day and sew these two pieces together. And so that always was interesting in how quiet a factory can be. My factory is not at all like that.
Well, let me ask you then, and tell me about the evolution of your father's company. So in the 1960s, when you were a boy, it was a moccasin company. And now, boy, if you go on your website, beautiful handmade shoes. I'm sure that there are lots of very well-heeled and even famous people around the world who wear them. Tell me about the evolution. How did Rancourt & Company go from being a moccasin maker to what it is today?
So it's a long story. I could take a whole hour.
Well, you don't get the whole hour. We got to share. But
so I'll just say this, that my dad was a contract manufacturer, and I became one.
And what does that mean?
Well, so we're making for other brands, and we use their names. So today, you know, at one point it was Cole Haan or Ralph Lauren, and his big customer was Quadi. And so as I got more involved with him in high school, and then after high school, I went to school for, you know, a couple of years and then joined him in a company that became ours in 1982. It was clear to me that, you know, making moccasins as a living was not going to sustain us for the future. And so Cole Haan became one of our biggest customers. And at that point, they wanted me to learn more about shoemaking. And so they would actually pay for me to travel to Italy and to South America and to other places in Europe. And that's when I really became to educate myself about other types of construction. And that's what you see on our site today, this evolution of moccasin making to now, as you said, you know, very sophisticated dress shoes and all leather shoes that I have on today. So, but it was important that that happened.
Is it important to your customers that they're shoes are made in America?
That's a good question. I would say, you know, we're developing a consumer base that likes the fact that they can buy shoes made in America. And I think, you know, to expand on that, they like the fact that they can, you know, talk to me or they can talk to our staff, ask questions. We can guide them in the purchasing, you know, the buying process from color to style to how to wear certain dress shoes and what occasions you're going to wear them for. And so I think it becomes as much about service as it is about actually the shoes being made in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about history a little bit. In doing research for today's program, I stumbled across the wonderful gem. It was a master's paper that was written in 1926 by a woman named Mary Lamy. And I'm wondering if she must be related to the Lamy-Wellahan family, about the history of shoemaking in Maine. And one thing I learned, Rachel, and maybe you've seen this same paper, is that shoemaking Maine really expanded after the Revolutionary War. I thought that was fascinating that before, towns had their own very small tannery. They're very, you know, some people making shoes in the home, but that after the Revolutionary War, Maine's shoes were needed.
Yes, absolutely. And it started, you know, before that when basically it was peddlers and cobblers that would travel from one village to the other. And then they discovered that it was better to kind of stay in one of the little villages and so forth. And it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that they went from actually hand sewing and stitching and so forth and making things the especially on the farms, the father would be doing the making the shoes for the family, and then the children, as they grew up, would learn how to make them. And then after the Revolutionary War, they started going into building the industrial part of it and going more into factory rather than just the small shops that were all over the place.
Is the reason that Maine's shoe industry exploded in the early 1900s because of the rivers? Was it because of the reputation of Maine shoes? Both and?
Both plus. Basically, yes, the rivers were important because the factories that they were starting to build. But in speaking with Dr. Bernard Laune, who was part of the family of the Laune Shoe Company, the interesting part was that Massachusetts was ahead of us, and when the people there found that the regulations were getting stronger and stronger, and it was getting hotter, the unions were getting into the major manufacturings, they decided to move up in Maine because Maine didn't have that. And so that's when the major part of the all the factories started building and so forth until the Great Strike of 1937.
And why don't you tell me a little bit about the Great Strike of 1937? Because I understand it was really the watershed moment for Maine shoe industry, or one of the watershed moments.
It was, because at that time there were so many of the people were trying to get more and better working conditions and so forth. And there were so many people that tried to, there were about 4,000 to 5,000 of the 63,000 shoe workers at the time that went on strike. And the problem happened when the government actually took the side of the management. And it's known as Red Wednesday, when the shoe workers tried to cross the bridge from Lewiston, from Auburn to Lewiston. And the governor had called in the National Army, and there was quite a bit of bloodshed and so forth. When I did the oral history of Dr. Bernard Laune at 15 years old, he was involved in it, and he said it is at that point in time that he decided that in his life that he would start working towards injustice because of what he found and saw and witnessed there at that shoe strike.
So, and this is Dr. Bernard Laune, who was a future winner for the Nobel Prize.
Yes, and the inventor of the defibrillator, cardiac defibrillator.
Jack, I want to talk to you about L.L. Bean's Bean Boots. I have a 15-year-old daughter that would not would not imagine a wardrobe without them. I know that you've had to add employees recently to keep up with demand. What was the biggest backlog you've had in the last few years for L.L. Bean Boots?
We've been up as high as 100,000.
Backlog of 100,000? Yeah. Oh, that must be a sleepless night for you.
Fortunately, it went down quickly. We were able to catch right up. It was nice to see. It was really good to see all the business. We've actually been able to hire people. It feels like for the last 5 or 6 years, we've been adding 100, 150 people every year. So it's a really good thing for Maine to help and put more people to work, but at the same time to see that footwear industry growing. When you walk into the two facilities that we have, it's really rewarding. You see the parking lot full, you see boots being made, and they're actually moving out the door just as fast as we can make them.
So there may be people in our audience who don't know the history of the Bean Boot. Can you give us the truncated version of Leon Wood's invention?
Sure. He was tired of getting his feet wet when he went out hunting in the woods, and he designed a rubber bottom with a leather top, and he actually made 100 pair, and he sent them out, and one of the things that happened was is the first 100 pair, 90 of them fell apart. Well, at least 90 were returned. And what we found out of that was he wanted to improve upon that. He figured out that, they can't have them falling apart. So such the guarantee is where it was created.
And what year was that?
Basically the same year, 1912 is when it was immediately in the testing part of it. After that, it just took off, and it's been the iconic you know, signature product for L.L. Bean since.
What do you think it is about the Bean boot?
It has a lot of tradition. It's a great, it's a comfortable boot. We've improved upon it over the years as far as subtle changes, but for the most part, it still has that same heritage look and appeal. You know, of course, probably the bright blue colors and blacks and the brighter colors that we have in the multicolors have changed over the years versus the plain brown, but it's still the same traditional quality boot that we've made, and it's manufactured the same way. So I think that's appealing to people, especially having a main product, U.S. product. It's great.
And you know, you're expanding now to meet demand. Do you see this as a trend, or do you see it as a long-term investment, or do you think it's fashion? I have no idea.
A little bit of the latter. I have no idea as far as the trend, but I would just say it definitely has caught people's attention. I think some of it is the fact that it's gone from just making, I mean, for many years we made brown, brown, and brown. And, you know, those are the only colors you could get. And now we've moved it to, you have multiple colors and different styles, different linings, and it's attracting to a wide range of people. And, of course, it's very trendy with the young folks, college and everything. It's great. So I do think a lot of it has to do with the changing and upkeeping of style with trend.
Okay, let me ask you about Rancourt. Mike, is your company growing? Is your customer base growing?
So when we launched Rancourt & Company back in 2009.
Right in the heat of the recession.
Yeah. In fact, the company that my wife and I had sold our factory to wanted to close the factory in Lewiston, and they were starting to shift more of their products offshore. So I asked my son if he wanted to join me, and we ended up making an offer to the company I worked for, and we bought it back in 2009. So the interesting part for us is that we, you know, having spent so much time manufacturing for other brands, contract manufacturing, didn't think it was going to happen this time around just because of the cost of buying a pair of shoes. And I mean, I was so wrong. We had this huge demand on us for the first 3 years. So over time, I started to reconsider whether or not that was really a sustainable future for us, and then decided it couldn't be and it shouldn't be. So as a result, we started to raise prices, and then pretty much strategized that we wanted to develop more of the Rancourt brand. And as a result, so our workforce has shrunk down, but now we make 90% of our shoes are made under the Rancourt label and Rancourt brand. So that's the important point in this, you know, this discussion about, yes, we're smaller, but now it's really our product.
Right. And you guys had some publicity during the Olympics. Tell me that story.
Yeah, so there's a good example of a long-term contract we had with Ralph Lauren, and they happened to have the contract to supply the Olympic team. And they approached us in 2015 about making a number of pairs of boat shoes for the team. And we were pretty excited to have that opportunity. And so, yeah, that unfolded from, you know, 1,000 pairs to, you know, thousands of pairs when it was all said and done. So
are these the boat shoes, the red, white, and blue boat
yes.
shoes? Did they wear
yeah.
them at opening ceremonies?
Both opening and closing.
So what was the smallest pair you made, and for whom, and what was the largest pair? Do you remember?
So, yeah, so on the ladies' size, the smallest pair size we made was a 5. And on the ladies, again, the largest we made was a 16. And on the men's, it was a 6 to an 18.
And do you know who got them?
No, we don't. Okay. Share that with me.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about shoemaking in Maine. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Dirigo Pines in Orono, offering a spectrum of retirement living options on a 68-acre wooded campus. DirigoPines.com.
Anti-German sentiment was intense after the U.S. entered the First World War. Its most violent moment was the lynching of Robert Prager.
The group lowered him down quickly, and he hollered once for the red, and they lowered it again, once for the white, and once for the blue.
I'm Robert Siegel, Wartime Hysteria, a century ago, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Trevor Noah finds surprising similarities between his childhood in Africa and life in Trump's America.
What are the chances Idi Amin literally saying, "I have the best brain," and Donald Trump going, "I have the best brain"? What are the chances?
The Daily Show's Trevor Noah, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour coming up Saturday at 2, and again Sunday evening at 11 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Shoemaking in Maine, the past and future of this major industry in our state. With me in the studio, Mike Rancourt, who is co-founder of Rancourt & Company in Lewiston. Jack Sampson is L.L. Bean's vice president of fulfillment, manufacturing, and logistics. And Rachel DeGragier is executive director of the Museum L.A. in Lewiston. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Ray Wentworth. She's the plant manager of the Skowhegan plant for New Balance. Hi, Ray. Thanks for joining us. Ray, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, terrific. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. New Balance continues to make shoes in Maine. How much is produced in Maine? How many people are employed, and how many shoes are you making?
We have about 900 associates that work in our three facilities in Maine. And we between those three facilities, we make approximately about, I'd say, 2 million pairs of shoes a year.
Wow. Most athletic shoes are now made outside the U.S., such as in Southeast Asia, where labor is cheaper. Why does New Balance continue to make shoes here?
Because we truly believe in keeping domestic manufacturing here and the craftsmanship here, and it allows us to control our own destiny when it comes to quality.
What is the latest with the U.S. military? Who buys from you? Who's going to be buying soon? Is it still sort of stuck up in the as part of this stuck in the bureaucratic machinery of government?
Well, it is ongoing, and again, I can't speak to the details of it, but I can tell you that I know that there has been movement, and it has been in the favor of domestic manufacturing.
Okay, and there already are some branches of the military that buy New Balance shoes, correct?
There are. Yep, there are different branches. I think that we have reached out to all of them, and throughout the years, I believe that all of the branches have purchased from us. And we are currently making a shoe that is 100% domestically made. All suppliers are here in the United States, which is exciting. And because one of the things that, you know, when these shoe factories went overseas, you know, part of the supply chain went with it. So it's challenging. But we are making a shoe called the 950, and it is 100% American made, and we're very proud of that shoe.
That's right. I read that shoemaking is sort of like auto manufacturing. It's really, really hard to just source from one country. So congratulations on that. I also know you have a brand new shoe, the 1978.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
It's very exciting. It's a shoe that is bringing in new technology, and that is made from out of our Norwich Walk facility. And they are making that currently today to get out into the market.
I know that there's controversy after New Balance stated support for Donald Trump's stance on the TPP back in November. People saying, and I'm going to talk about this with L.L. Bean, too, who knew that shoes could be political? Did that impact sales when there was some people calling for a boycott?
I cannot speak to that personally, but from what I understand, that did not impact our sales.
Okay. What do you think the future holds for shoemaking in Maine and in the U.S. in general?
Well, I think it's very encouraging, and I think that we're at a time where especially New Balance and the others that have stayed here on U.S. soil, I think that there's almost a rally in regards to keeping manufacturing here in the United States. And by doing that, and again, you know, it's been a challenge for all manufacturing in the United States, like I spoke to in regards to the supply chains and keeping it here. But, to have that grit to stay here and to keep moving towards it. I feel that we're in a really good place, and I think it's just going to continue as the United States brings on, and this administration does kind of support the domestic manufacturing. I think that shoe manufacturing, you'll see it coming back with other manufacturing that used to be here in the United States.
Well, thank you, Ray. Ray Wentworth, New Balance's Skowhegan Plant Manager.
Thank you.
And I want to pose that same question to you, Jack. You, L.L. Bean had its own controversy over one of its board members making a political contribution. How did that affect the company?
The tweets were just a temporary diversion. We basically focused on making products, making the boots, and providing the customer service. We just kept the course, stayed focused.
Okay. I'm going to move to the calls now. We're going to go to Robert, who's calling from Lewiston. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I had a question sort of on this topic about whether buying these products is sort of a reflection of our values and the political aspects of buying boots, in particular from L.L. Bean. So, you know, on the one hand, I want to support American-made products. I want to support Maine-made products. I think that's like a emblematic of my values. But on the other hand, you know, I'm somebody who's strongly opposed to Trump, and it does seem like it's the support of the board member to the Trump administration buying L.L. Bean boots does seem like it's also a sign of that value. So I'm feeling this tension, and I was wondering if the folks from L.L. Bean could comment on that.
I mean, as I said, we kept the focus. We really were focused on making quality products, good boots, and customer service. A little bit above me. I really didn't have a lot of involvement in the actual tweets or things like that.
Thanks, Robert, for your call. Let's see here. We're going to go to Barbara, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Well, I wanted to remind people that L.L. Bean is in Freeport, and years ago, Freeport had at least six shoe factories making I believe they made mostly loafers, and some of them built made shoes just for L.L. Bean to sell.
Well, thank you, Barbara, for that reminder. And, Rachel, that's a great segue. Why don't you tell us where in Maine we saw factories in the last century? We know Lewiston was sort of – Auburn was considered the shoe capital. Where in, now we're learning Freeport, six in Freeport. Where else were we seeing lots of shoe factories?
Oh, you well, like you have New Balance in Skowhegan, and they Livermore Falls, Jay, Scarborough. They all had, you know, shoe factories kind of moved along. As a matter of fact, somebody had said that there was kind of a trail of shoe factories from Lewiston Auburn on down through Freeport and into Portland and so forth. And it's right in 1985, for example, Eastland Shoe Factory in Freeport, they would box 6,000 new pairs of shoes ready to go out the door, you know, every day. And so it's very important, you know, for all the shoe companies to be able to follow through on what was happening.
I do want to add, so, you know, Bass Shoe was in the Wilton area.
And Dexter, obviously,
yeah,
Dexter.
Dexter, yeah.
But Bass had, you know, such an left an impression, a huge impression in the country, in the world regarding hand sewns. I mean, they were the hand sewn. The Weegee was the hand sewn to wear, own, you know, back in the 70s and 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, very important brand in regards to popularizing the hand sewn moccasin look.
Do you believe that it's because of Bass's reputation that helps Rancourt and Company today?
Still do. I mean, we get requests frequently. Just recently, a college is doing a play, and it's based in the 60s. And the department that's responsible for outfitting the cast called and asked if we could make them an actual Bass Weegee that was popular back in the 60s. So, yeah, in our Japanese customers, they talk about Bass Weegee, the European. So, yeah, it's still very, very popular and important.
Well, let me ask you the question that was something Ray brought up and a question I asked her, Jack, which is, do you see the future as bright for shoe manufacturing in Maine, or do you see the L.L. Bean boot as sort of its own creature, a kind of special thing?
The Bean boot is definitely the focus for us, but we also look for other programs that we can bring in. And You know, yes. I mean, I think we would definitely look for more made in Maine products if we can find them. The hardest part is, as Ray said, it's finding the materials and the supply chain to keep that supply going. That's the struggle we have. You know, to make any type of quantity and find that product in U.S. is very, very difficult. You have to look outside. It's a struggle.
And you're making – L.L. Bean is making its own soles now, right?
We do. We make our own bottoms for our bean boots. And it's – we brought it in-house. We've always had it in the U.S., but we've brought it into Maine and into our own control. Very similar to Ray. It helps with our own quality control and your own demand. You're not having to have a large inventory or supply.
Did somebody have to design a special machine? I'm trying to imagine the engineer tasked with the job of – you get this rubber sole, right?
Right. The molds are made for us and designed for us, but the machine itself is an Italian machine, made molding machine, and it is set up for us, but it is not anything unique to the industry.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we're going to go to Ron, who's calling from Lebanon. Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Hi. I called you yesterday on another subject, but I have a comment relative to history, to the people in Maine. My great-grandfather was the United Shoe Machinery Corporation representative for all of northern New England, and it was his job to go into the factories and sell the machinery and set it up and then maintain it to... And there were many, many, many different kinds of machines that they built at that time, back in the 1920s and 30s. And when I was a little guy running around, I went in the garage, and there's all these wooden boxes with USMC on it. And I said, "Grandpa, were you in the Marines?" and he laughs and says, "No." He says, "That's the United Shoe Machinery Corporation."
Oh, that's a great story. Where did you grow up, Ron?
Right here in Lebanon, Maine, Milton, New Hampshire, Rochester, New Hampshire. My great-grandfather settled in Berwick, Maine. So he took care of all the shoe shops around Sanford and Summersworth, Berwick, South Berwick. And he was a busy man.
When you mentioned that... Oh, go ahead.
My mom was a top stitcher in the shoe shop for years. My dad was a bed laster. And he worked in World War II. He worked in the shoe shop making combat boots.
Wow.
And he used to take me in on Saturday mornings, and I'd hang around while he was working and get to talk with all the people. Then later on, when I got old enough, I became a belt boy in the stitching room. And there was a little benefit to that, too. I got to flirt with all the girls, you know.
Ron, I so appreciate your calling in today. And, you know, when you mentioned the United Shoe Machinery Corporation, all three of my guests nodded with a familiarity and big smiles. Go ahead, Rachel.
Well, I was just going to mention, one day somebody came to me and asked if I wanted to see his father's U.S. patents for shoe machines. And so I said, yeah, because, and when he brought in the patents, I couldn't believe it. I asked him if he, you know, how long he had gone to school, and he said sixth grade. And I looked at those, and those designs and diagrams were feats of engineering and whatnot. And he actually was an inventor who invented machines for United Shoe Machinery. And as a matter of fact, they're still being used today. Oh, that gentleman is gone, but they're still being used today. And it just shows the creativity that our people had in Maine and still have. And that's probably one of the reasons why Rancourt Shoe is still moving forward, because of that, you know, we can do it type of spirit. Yeah. and we can move forward. And the same thing with L.L. Bean. And Ted Johansson from Falcon Shoe, when I asked him, "Well, how come you stayed alive when all the others went down?" He said, "Because most of the owners of the shoe shops were salesmen." And he said, "We were engineers. So we were able to figure out how to retool and remake ourselves. And that's the ones that have survived today." I think that's what you're seeing.
And which company was that?
It was Falcon Shoe.
Falcon Shoe.
Yes.
Wow. Ron, what a great call. We have an email from Michael. My grandmother led the 750 women on strike in Skowhegan in 1937. My father and mother worked in the shoe industry in Augusta for many years, and I worked at R.P. Hazard every summer while in high school. It provided for me and money for me when I went off to college. Another great story from somebody with a family history. We'll go to Mary, who's calling from Winslow. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wondered if someone could comment a little bit more. I think you did mention the impact of being able to source materials locally. And back in the 90s, I think it might have been the reason for the decline of the shoe industry, where foreign materials were being used more and more, and you were no longer even making the leather here in Maine. The Prime Tanning and others had to close down due to environmental regulations. So how will that change, if indeed it could, under the Trump administration, and the ability for manufacturing of shoes to grow more in the United States? That's my question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would just say that a lot of things like the leather, for example, Tasman leather here in Maine, they've moved here to Maine. They're in Heartland, and we buy a lot of leather from them. And
Tasman,
yeah, and they're a very good quality conscious company, and we've been buying leather from them for quite some time. So I do see it coming back in small pieces, you know, as far as, you know, smaller companies. But to get quantity, that's where we struggle. When you're looking to make 4,000 pair a day, it's very difficult to get the quantity that you need. So you have to sometimes rely on bringing it in from outside the country.
Do you have thoughts, Mike?
So we source from Tasman as well, and then our primary leather supplier is out of Chicago. It's Horween, the fifth generation. And different, you know, from the standpoint of economy of scale, we're much smaller. And so, you know, ours is really all about crafting, you know, hand making, you know, a beautiful pair of shoes, and having our customer, you know, who love shoes, by the way, that's why they do business with us. They see it as almost an investment. So the demand on our side is different, but we do struggle with sourcing of soles. We have one rubber sole company in the United States, so we buy, and the best rubber soles for us come out of France, so we do invest a lot in sourcing the best products we can find, and we don't necessarily say they have to be made in the United States, even though we'd like them to be made in the United States.
Right.
Mary, thank you so much for calling with your question. We are going to have to go to another break. If you would like to call and join the conversation on shoemaking in Maine, our phone number 1-800-399-3566.
The life of Carlos Rafael conjures up images from another immigrant story. A young man who comes to America and becomes a businessman straddling both sides of the law, on his way to becoming the most powerful fisherman on the East Coast.
You know, there were fishermen who admired him for his shrewd business acumen and others who resented him for his dubious dealings.
On Next, we'll learn about the man known in the Port of New Bedford as the Codfather. Join us for Next from the New England News Collaborative.
That's coming up tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And coming up in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour today, World Affairs, a panel discussion on the Trump presidency and America's evolving relationship with Asia. Again, that's coming up in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the importance of shoemaking in Maine. Joining me today, Jack Sampson, who is representing L.L. Bean, Rachel DeGrosier, who's executive director of Museum L.A., and Mike Rancourt from Rancourt & Company. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Going to go to Ann, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I just wanted to make a quick comment that if you are opposed to the board member supporting Trump, then I would suggest boycotting her business instead of L.L. Bean.
All right, Ann. I think you're not the only person who feels that way. Thank you so much for calling and joining the conversation. Again, who knew that shoes would be so political? Rachel, earlier we were talking about the height of the shoemaking industry in Maine. And I thought it was 50,000 people, but you say more than 60,000 people who worked in shoemaking. But that wasn't all, right? This was a industry that had really a multiplier effect.
Yes. One of the things that always intrigued me was, why did we get so depressed after the mills and the shoe shops closed? And when I started doing the oral histories and so forth, it came to light. It wasn't just the shoe shops. It was like the people that serviced them, the people who made the shoelaces, the people who did the metal die cuts, and the people who actually did the shoe last and so forth. So all those little, you know, mom and pop, and all even some larger companies, when the shoe shops all died and went away, they had nobody to service anymore. So if it's hard today, you lost that. Over the years, you lost those people and those skills and the supplies. So it's no wonder that today it's hard to be able to. So it wasn't just the shoe shops
right.
themselves. It was the people that, the suppliers.
And you talk about losing the people and the skills. L.L. Bean is hiring now.
Exactly.
Are you able to find the people who have the skills?
We do have people coming through the door, but with the unemployment rate so low right now, we are struggling to fill the positions. We've have a pretty much a standing order right now for people that are looking for jobs to come through the door. And
so they don't even have to have experience in the shoe industry.
For the last, I would say at least the last 10 years, we haven't found too many people coming through the door with stitching experience. Most of the time, our training programs are designed to start right from scratch. We test, see if you have the skill sets to do the basic stitching.
Some
pieces.
Basic eye-hand coordination.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then we move into, more depth stitching, free stitching, we call it, basically. And being able to have that finesse is really important. There can be a high turnover rate for stitchers, but it's a long training curve. And we've reduced it over the years, but we started out at a 26-week training curve, and we're now down to between 10 and 12 weeks. But it's still... Sometimes it's a struggle to fill all those positions.
And what about you, Mike? How do you find people to make handcrafted shoes?
So we're fortunate in Lewis and Auburn that we have a good size population of African immigrants, and so yes, we have to, like Jack just stated, we have to set up a training program, but we've been successful in converting, people who've never worked in a factory before, or a shoe factory, I should say, and having them be, not just, producing quality work, but also reliable and learning about, the organization of a manufacturing and how we're all interreliant on each other. And so it's been successful. And, thank God we've got that population base now.
We're going to go to Sean, who's calling from Norwalk. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I got a question for the... Hello?
Go ahead. Yep.
I guess this should be a question for the L.L. Bean guy. I was wondering, it seems to me like you guys could be making work boots, or someone in Maine should be making a good pair of work boots, because when I first started in the trades, it used to be no one would ever buy a boot made in China. And now there's only a couple companies really that sell boots that aren't made in China, work boots. And it just seems to me like we could be maybe L.L. Bean, probably not the Rancor guy, but maybe we should be making some more work boots around here.
Is that something you've considered?
Well, I think it's a great suggestion. Right at the moment, we have our hands full trying to fill the capacity with our current work, bean boot. And like I said, finding people and finding the materials has been the struggle. So right now we're focusing on keeping the bean boot volumes in hand. But I think it's a great suggestion. We'd love to have more work boots made in Maine.
Sean, thanks for calling. We've got Joan in Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Joan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. This is a great conversation. My grandfather came over from Ireland when he was 14 years old and by himself, and started working in the leather industry over at A.C. Lawrence, and learned the tanning part of the industry, and ended up the treasurer of A.C. Lawrence Leather. And my father also got into the tanning business and worked for A.C. Lawrence and then went to a tannery in South Paris, Maine, and then the one Prime Tanning. And when he was at Prime Tanning, he figured out how to make the waterproof leather, and that's where Timberland first started with their shoes.
Well, Joan, thanks so much for your story. You should see the smiles in the room. The folks who work in the shoe industry and have a history, you all really feel passionately about it, don't you?
So the first tannery I ever visited was actually A.C. Lawrence in South Ferris. So that's why I was smiling. I can still remember the staff, and not only that, it was a disgusting place just because it had raw materials, and I was like, oh my God, I'm not sure how these folks can do this day in and day out. But they made this beautiful product that we used on our boat shoes, and to this day, I always had great feelings about them as a tannery.
Joan, thanks so much for calling. Another Joan sent us an email. You were just asking about the cities in Maine that had shoe factories in the past. One that wasn't mentioned, it was eventually, but I guess we hadn't mentioned at the time, was Wilton, where my grandfather, Charles Scott, was a stitcher for, my screen's jumping around on me again, was a stitcher for Bass Shoes. The Bass family lived on a beautiful house on the hill, and George Bass's children were friends with my mother and aunt, despite vast differences of wealth between the two families. We'll go to Bill, who's calling from Bristol. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. One other town that was not mentioned is Berwick, and Norway and Wells were all manufacturing shoes in the 60s. But as I said to you earlier, I was a chemist that went to work for United Shoe Machinery in 1962, and I felt that as a monopolistic company and the major force in the United States, they didn't seem to be aware in the 60s that the shoe industry was fleeing to Italy and other places. And I was not surprised when I discovered in the 80s that they had ceased to exist. And I thought, what a shame it was that because of lack of foresight, those people contributed to the loss of the shoe business in this country. But they had, as somebody mentioned earlier, the engineers who designed equipment, their manufacturing, the stuff that made the shoes, were very clever people, and many of them never graduated from junior high, much less high school, and they started out sweeping the floors and worked their way up to being designers, and they were very clever, and they made equipment that was not going to fall apart in a year. It was made to last forever. I want to tell you, it was huge. A great manufacturing company with bad management and went down the drain. Very sad. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mike.
So, again, my memory, the first sole stitching machine that my father, you couldn't buy it. It was a USM machine. And they didn't sell their machinery. You had to actually rent it, or you had to pay. There was actually a ticker, a clock on the machine, and it would count how many stitches you actually produced or used. And that's how you determine how you were going to pay for a machine. So they were a monopoly, and they were broken apart at some point, but my memory of this is that they were one of the largest manufacturers in the world at the time, if not the incredibly wealthy, but they were a monopoly.
Mm. Jennifer, I'd like to jump in a little bit in the sense that, people don't remember that we used to be called the White Canvas State here, because in the early days of baseball, when the baseball players started wearing their white canvas shoes with the leather trimming and so forth, people in Auburn picked up on that and were able to, in between 1922 and 1923, they did more than 10 million canvas shoes that were turned out in Auburn. So they specialized, and they used their creativity to do things. The same thing as we had a company, I can't remember the exact name of it, but they were the ones that made all the ballet shoes for everybody in the world for the ballet that they, So I think the creativity and the inventiveness and the go-get-go of our people is probably what built it. And I think today, hopefully, that's what is going to bring it back.
We'll go to John in Hampstead, New Hampshire. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I'm tuning in a little late. I don't know if you guys have spoken about, a lot about Cole Haan and the success of Cole Haan there in Maine, and mainly George Denny and his rise through Cole Haan to build it to the company where he was able to then sell it to Nike. And then obviously I think somebody in the Raincourt area might, you know, shake his head at the quality that's gone on over the years with Cole Haan. But I find it a fascinating story. I used to work for them in their retail store. And out of that retail store, the very first one they ever had, because they were a wholesale company, a lot of the people that went on to do wonderful things and expand Cole Haan around the world with their retail stores came out of that store. And George Denny would show up ultimately in his Bentley, park it next to the building, and come in. If there was a light out in the building, he would insist that it be changed. But he was a perfectionist, and that's what he started out as, sewing, and built Cole Haan. If somebody just wants to talk to Cole Haan, their success story, I'll take my answer off the air. But it was a great company to work for. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
So we have a long history with Cole Haan, and, you know, with my dad and I, and then myself. And so, again, it was important to them for me to learn how to make a more sophisticated shoe, and, you know, dress shoes, and learn about materials. And that was really their story. And I think that's what made them successful. And, oh, by the way, George Denny just released a book recently. So if you want to read the story of Cole Haan, he's done a great job of telling it. And yeah, great brand, you know, really learned a lot with them.
That's great. And we have an email from Carolyn. Please don't forget about Dexter Shoe and the incredible philanthropic influence of the Alphon family. Good email. We've got, I think, time to squeeze in one call. Casey, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to relay a little bit of, you know, my story. But I grew up as a kid, my grandmother was LL secretary. So I used to play at the desk at the double desk that LL and my grandmother used to sit at. But we watched, you know, beans grow and grow and grow from the shoe, you know, shoes in that be made on the second floor. And I give a lot of compliments to Beans for now actually doing what they can, sourcing things locally. They may not be able to get the materials, but they're sending a lot of business to local companies from all over the state. And, you know, maybe a service end of it versus a materials end of it.
All right. Well, Casey, thanks. You're going to be our last call today because we're almost out of time. Anything you want to say briefly, Steve? I mean, Jack?
No, I would just say he's right. You know, we do a really good job of trying to source as much as we can from the U.S. and from Maine as much as possible.
Well, that's our last word tonight. Thank you so much, all of you. Rachel DeGrozier, Executive Director of Museum LA in Lewiston, Mike Raincourt, co-founder of the family-owned Raincourt & Company in Lewiston, and Jack Sampson, L.L. Bean's Vice President of Fulfillment, Manufacturing, and Logistics. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the summer job market in Maine. We'll learn about the challenges some businesses are facing finding part-time and temporary workers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.